supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Philadelphia Congressman Bob Brady announces he will not seek re-election this year. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The move comes after Brady was dogged for months by a federal investigation into payments made to an opponent who abandoned his run for Brady's seat in 2012. Joining us to sort it all out is WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. And Dave, over the many months you've been reporting on this federal investigation, we've seen indictments and guilty pleas. What, if anything, did this have to do with Brady's decision to end his congressional career?
Well, Dave, he says nothing, but I'm not so sure. You know, to review what this was all about, you know, Brady had a primary challenger 6 years ago in 2012. His name was Jimmy Moore. Not a serious challenger, but federal prosecutors say in court filings that Brady and Moore had a meeting at which they cut a deal. Moore would get out of the primary in return for $90,000 from Brady's campaign fund to retire his debts. The money was paid. The financial transactions resulted in campaign finance violations. Four people have been charged. Three pled guilty, but not Brady. He was not charged, and his lawyer has now told him he doesn't think he will be. Brady met with reporters today and said he was never worried because he knew he didn't do anything wrong. So I asked him, well, now that the prospects of charges have passed, what about this meeting that the feds say you had with Jimmy Moore that led to this exchange?
No.
In return for him dropping out, what exactly did happen?
No. Next question.
What did happen? Was there a
meeting? No. You asked me a question. Can I tell you? I told you no.
So he was pretty animated about that. You know, Dave, I think this whole thing was embarrassing to Bob Brady. And now that he's passed it and the prospect of a competitive re-election battle looms, something he has never had, I just think it's all a lot less fun. And he said it's time for him to come home and spend time with his family.
So on to that re-election battle. Describe the scramble for that open seat.
I've got five people who have expressed interest, and that was before Brady bailed out of it. Nina Ahmed announced earlier she has some money to bring in. Rich Laser is a Kenny administration official who would have support in the building trades. And then there are three others that I know of, Lindy Lee, Willie Singletary, and Michelle Lawrence. But who knows if this race is even going to be fought in the current district boundaries.
Exactly, because there's a state Supreme Court order from the gerrymandering case to redraw all the congressional boundaries. What effect might that have?
Dave, we could see the Brady district disappear. Remember, the goal in drawing these new districts is to make them more compact, not to break up counties, which invites gerrymandering. Look at Philadelphia today, and there are three partial congressional seats. Brady, Brendan Boyle, and Dwight Evans all have a seat which is part city, part suburbs. The city, at about 1.5 million people, is a right size for two congressional districts. So you could well see it divided along an east-west or north-south axis into districts in which Congressman Brendan Boyle gets one, Congressman Dwight Evans gets the other, and the Brady district is scattered to the suburbs.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. Let's next pick up with politics across the Delaware River. New Jersey senior U.S. Senator Democrat Bob Menendez will run for re-election this fall, free from concern about the potential to be retried on corruption charges. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has been following Menendez and joins me now. And Joe, first up, a quick review of the original charges and subsequent trial.
Well, the Justice Department said years ago that Menendez and his close friend, an eye doctor from Florida, were engaging in a bribery scheme for years in which Menendez offered government favors to this friend, Salomon Melgen, and in return he got lavish gifts, international trips, and political contributions.
And so what happened last week that set up the decision today?
Well, there was a trial last year of the two men. It ended in a mistrial because the jury couldn't come up with a verdict after a long enough time. And then the Justice Department last week announced that it would retry the two men on the bribery, conspiracy, and fraud charges. A day after they said that, the judge in the case threw out some of the bribery charges against Menendez, the ones that had to do with political contributions. And so a week later, fast forward to today, the Justice Department says, well, we know we said we'd retry these two guys, but in light of the charges being thrown out, we're going to not retry them at all. And that means that these two men won't face a second trial.
Like Brady, Menendez said today that, quote, he never wavered in his innocence and belief that justice would prevail. Is he likely to have challengers in the fall?
Menendez is likely to have challengers, but I think it's fair to say he'll have an easier time running for re-election this year, not under this legal cloud from the Justice Department and not, you know, wondering whether and when he'll face a second trial on bribery and conspiracy charges.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY New Jersey correspondent Joe Hernandez on Newsworks Tonight. You've probably heard that city workers in Philadelphia slathered Crisco onto street poles to discourage Eagles fans from climbing them after the NFC title game two Sundays ago. And it got a lot of laughs, but all that shortening also greased a decades-old national narrative that Eagles fans are unruly. WHYY's Aaron Mozell looked into whether that reputation is deserved.
The NFC Championship game was a blowout win for the Eagles. People were pretty pumped about it. This was Frankford Avenue in Northeast Philly that night. Not far away, police shut down a major intersection so hundreds of fans could celebrate in the streets. Across the city, police only made 6 arrests. That didn't surprise Glenn Macnow, a longtime host at Sports Radio 94 WIP. He says the overwhelming majority of Eagles fans behave themselves.
Philadelphia Eagle fans and fans of the other teams in this city are loyal, hardworking, long-suffering, terrifically dedicated, ardent fans who unfortunately get lumped in with the one half of 1% who are, in fact, Visigoths.
So why the bad rap? Macnow says it all stems from a snowy, now infamous, Christmas Day game in 1968.
The Santa that was supposed to perform that day didn't show up, so they managed to pull a 21-year-old kid out of the crowd in a Santa suit, little drunk, little scrawny. He marched across the field, and some Eagle fans, who, by the way, were sitting in seats covered with snow because they had never cleared it out before the game, decided to send some snowballs his way.
Sportscasters have talked about it ever since. Putting a courtroom in the basement of Veterans Stadium, where the Eagles played before moving to Lincoln Financial Field, has also fueled national perceptions. The idea came after a raucous Monday night game in 1997.
There were an inordinate amount of fistfights in the stands. Some people estimated over 60 fights.
Now retired Judge Seamus McCaffrey presided over the stadium courtroom on a volunteer basis to deal with disorderly conduct cases. He says a lot of incidents revolved around alcohol and the bodily release of that alcohol. But now and then, things got strange.
It was the last night of Veterans Stadium. The fans all wanted a piece of the stadium. And here was this young guy from the suburbs, and he was running down the ramp, screaming and yelling on top of his lungs, and he was wearing a toilet seat around his neck. He wanted to keep a toilet seat of Veterans Stadium.
More recently, a fan was arrested before the NFC title game for allegedly punching a state police horse in the face. The incident made a big splash, even though Eagles fans are statistically better behaved than some of their counterparts in the league. A Washington Post investigation found that between 2011 and 2015, Philly averaged 3 arrests per game, a fraction of the totals at the top of the list. The Chargers, who have a zero-tolerance policy, averaged nearly 25 arrests per game during the same stretch. That didn't comfort longtime Vikings fan Jana Hokanson, especially after she arrived at Lincoln Financial Field for that late January playoff game. Outside the stadium, Hokanson says she saw a man get hit in the head with a can so hard he started bleeding. Things weren't much better inside. She saw other Vikings fans get spit on, food was thrown at her sister.
Then a few rows back from us, a guy started throwing beer cans and it hit me, and that's when I was just like, I really had had enough by then.
Hokanson and her family were escorted out of the game after the third quarter. Mark Lifton, a New York Giants fan, refuses to even try attending an Eagles game because of experiences like Hokanson's and one he had at a Phillies game years ago. He was also hit with an open beer can because he was wearing a New York Mets hat. He also says a fan slapped him in the face, and so he figures it's best to stay away from Eagles fans.
They kind of wear their reputation as being a little psychotic as a badge of honor to some extent.
Macnow, the radio host, says there will always be a few knuckleheads who act out when there's a big sports event. And because this is Philly, those knuckleheads will always get more attention than they really deserve.
Our grandfathers carried this. Our fathers carried this curse. We're going to carry it. And I expect my kids are going to carry it forever. Oh, you Philadelphia fans. It's just the way it's going to be.
Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Last year, 317 people were murdered in Philadelphia, the most killings the city has seen in 5 years. To the public, most of the victims remain unknown, the stories of their lives never told. But as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, a new project is bringing the statistics alive by telling the story of every homicide victim in the city.
Trina Singleton picked up the paper the day after her son was murdered in Southwest Philadelphia. The headline read, "Violent Day in Philly. 10 people shot, 3 of them fatally." What the article didn't mention was that one of those three was Singleton's 24-year-old son, Daryl.
Daryl was very friendly. He had a lot of personality. He liked helping people.
He was skinny. He had a trim goatee. He wore Malcolm X-style glasses. And at the time of his death, he was in school studying to be an EMT and babysitting on the side.
He didn't have a criminal background. He wasn't a troublemaker.
But the life of Daryl, the eldest of her three children, was summarized in just one newspaper paragraph. The article described the Tuesday he died as, quote, a day of mayhem. Philadelphia lawyer Cletus Lyman wants the murder statistics that contribute to street mayhem turned into real stories. He's launched a nonprofit website called Philadelphia Obituary Project.
I remember having discussions occasionally when I'd meet journalists, and I'd complain about this problem. Why don't you follow up on this? And I guess it's a problem of space. And they would say, yes, yeah, we just don't have time to do this.
Lyman's originally from Hazleton, a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania. There, he says, everyone got an obituary, whether you're a baker, a bus driver, or a CEO. And that's not true in a city as large and violent as Philadelphia, where the hundreds murdered every year often turn into mere data points.
They might give you a map with little dots on it. That's all most of these people were, as far as the what information you could get publicly. There were dots on a map.
Turning a single dot into a full-bodied story was therapeutic for Trina Singleton.
It does help the family with the healing and grieving process. We are able to reflect on the good parts of that person and not just what happened to them.
The project has completed dozens of profiles by freelance reporters. Albert Stumm oversees the Obituary Project stories. He's a former Philadelphia Daily News editor. He's now a writer living in Barcelona.
Every single victim is a person, and every single person had hopes and dreams. They had people who loved them. They had something in their lives that made them special, and those are the things that we are trying to focus on.
Stumm says the project stories are different than a traditional newspaper obituary, which would highlight both the good and the bad about a person's life. Instead, the Obituary Project lets the family decide what about a victim's past is included. Stumm says many families feel like their loved one is being blamed for being killed when articles focus exclusively on what led to the death. He has a different vision.
Not be saying, hey, yeah, well, he sounds like a nice guy, but what did he do to get himself in that position?
Right now, Lyman, the lawyer, is providing funding for the project. But he said soon the group will be launching a fundraising campaign. Because if they want to write about every murder victim in the city, which sometimes means several people in one day, it'll take more than just a few part-time journalists. At the Philadelphia Police Department headquarters, Commissioner Richard Ross says he hopes the Obituary Project wakes people up to the human toll of the city's high homicide rate.
We've all got to play a role in stemming the tide of this violence.
Convincing witnesses to cooperate is one of the biggest things that gets in the way of police arresting killers. Maybe, Ross says, putting faces to the numbers will encourage more people to step forward to help police solve murders.
These people shouldn't be relegated to a stat or a statistic. I mean, at the end of the day, you're talking about people, regardless of what may have happened that caused their demise, and it's all unfortunate.
Though participating in the Obituary Project was part of Singleton's healing process, the day of her son's death will never leave her. Her other son called her husband to share the grim news. At the time, her husband was out shopping for Daryl's birthday.
Daryl and my husband are born on the same day. So my husband and my son, they both share the same birthday. So we had plans for the next. So it was kind of hard.
Singleton says the project has given her a new sense of community, bringing her closer to other families who have lost loved ones to murder. But she says it wasn't a community she was ever expecting to be a part of. which she says underscores how common murder is to many families in Philadelphia.
We didn't want our children to turn out like some others that we had, you know, some others that we had seen. So we tried hard. And for it to happen anyway, it's kind of like, well, you try to do the right thing, you know, and then it happens anyway.
Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
This evening's forecast, cloudy skies falling back to 29 degrees overnight. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Thanks for being a YStream supporter of WHYY. I'm Dave Heller. Let's take a music break with keyboardist Patrick O'Hearn. This is Crossing the Divide. Thank you. That's Patrick O'Hearn on an array of keyboards, percussion, and bass from his CD, Metaphor. He was joined by guitarist David Torn. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on Pledge-Free Y-Stream.
Supporting WHYY, Comcast. Comcast is a proud partner of Team USA, and with Xfinity's viewing experience, Comcast is proud to support Team USA and bring the Olympic Winter Games 2018 to every hometown in America.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. A small Philadelphia theater company is taking on a big project, producing a trilogy of plays back-to-back for 5 months, culminating in a 9-hour performance of all of them in one day. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports it will be the first time the complete Lighty Breeze cycle by John Guare will be staged.
The three plays are set around the American Civil War when a battlefield nurse named Lighty Breeze witnesses the horrors of battle. It's the largest play of the three, produced by the company Ego Poe, with a cast of 2 dozen actors. My heart is filled with trouble. In the second play, Lighty convinces a handful of friends to abandon the war and retreat to Nantucket Island in Massachusetts to form a self-reliant utopian society. The third play traces the next generation, Lighty's daughter, trying to recover from the fallout of that utopia.
There's women on the other side! There's water on the other side!
The plays were first written in reverse order and staged individually in the early 1980s, they were met with mixed reviews. The playwright, John Guare, had had critical hits with House of Blue Leaves and the film Atlantic City. His most popular work, 6 Degrees of Separation, was still ahead of him at the time. With these plays, critics were scratching their heads, wondering what Guare was doing messing around in the Civil War.
In writing in New York, being, you know, born in New York City, being a New York City writer, I was drawing on the same material that a lot of people were drawing on, and I wanted a world that was completely mine.
This is John Guare.
My parents had been born in the 1890s, and I wondered what life was like for them. And then I loved Nantucket. Nantucket had been a savior for me in the early 70s. Nantucket's a place where you go to change your life, at least then, when it was a faraway island before it became a hedge fund billionaire's mecca because it's so hard to get to.
No one has ever tried to produce all three plays at once until the artistic director of Ego Poe, Lane Savidov, could pull it together with the help of the Pew Foundation. 16 years ago, Savidov worked as an assistant to Guare.
It's when I hit the Lighty Breeze plays that I was sort of blown away and realized that there was this sort of hidden treasure in American theater, and that potentially the great American theater epic that everybody has been waiting for is actually sitting right there.
Savidov believes that for the Lighty Breeze plays to be truly appreciated, you have to see all three of them. Only then can the play cycle reveal its scope and depth. He says the full meaning of the third play requires audiences to experience the epic adventure of the first and the psychological realism of the second.
That only makes sense, that conclusion, that final form, if we go through the melodrama and through the psychological realism to get there. And that tripartite journey is the internal journey of the main character, Joshua, who goes through all three plays and has to go through a journey of sort of finding out what is his legacy on Earth.
Savidov is staging one of the plays every month this spring in February, March, and April. And then in May, he's offering a marathon performance of all three in one weekend. And then for the hearty, all three in one day, stretching over 9 hours. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.